Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Look Ahead podcast. I'm your host, Vagha Maradian. Joining me, as he does every Monday, is my good friend Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners for a look at the week ahead and whatever else is on his mind. And we are joined by another dear friend, former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who is a cornerstone of our Friday Washington Roundtable. He counts the Center for Strategic and International Studies among his many affiliations, and he's joining us to discuss Iran's unprecedented attack on Israel over the weekend and what's next in the wake of that attack. Guys, thanks very much for joining me, Dov, especially so for because you're going to be joined us on Friday, and you'll join us again next Friday. Welcome back. Before we go further, a word from our sponsors. HII is the designer and operator of the U.S. Navy's live virtual constructive training enterprise, the largest LVC enterprise in the U.S. Department of Defense. HII delivering the advantage. Dov, unprecedented attack by Iran on Israel over the weekend, and doing so directly, not through proxies, as Byron suggested in a thoughtful note immediately after the attack. It does constitute a breakdown of deterrence. Indeed, it was a direct Iranian attack on Eilat on April the 1st that prompted Israel to destroy an Iranian consulate in Damascus. That was the base of operations for Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps commanders, regionally. Given that it's Iran's proxies, whether Hamas, whether Hezbollah, and whether the Houthis that are causing all of this mayhem. The attack was composed of about 120 ballistic missiles, about 30 or 40 cruise missiles, and the remaining 120 or so Shahed explosive attack drones. Almost all of them were intercepted in what can only be categorized as an extraordinary coalition operation involving US, UK, Jordan, Israel, and other allies and partners. Only one young girl appears to have been injured in the attack. What's weird is why Iran decided now to do this. Was it basically trying to get cred for proxies, as you've suggested, that are a little more gung-ho in attacking Israel maybe than Iran is directly? Is it that Iran has quietly, as we discussed in our group, quietly gone nuclear, and this attack was a test in a way to maybe slip a few nuclear wolves into a larger herd of conventional attack sheep, not to overdo the analogy? And then, you know, what does it mean next? In part because Iran just took the focus off of Israel as the bad guy and put the bullseye on itself. What are the dynamics? Why did things change now? I mean, I should also note the Iranians could have done this a lot earlier because Israel is complicit in, conducting numerous highly successful strikes on Iran over the past decade or so. Anyway, take this in any direction you want to take it.
Well, thanks. Look, we don't know really why the Iranians did what they did. The Iranians, of course, are congenitally liars. The argument that Israel hit an embassy is ludicrous. Beginning in 79, the Iranians seized our hostages and our embassy, and they've blown up other facilities and embassies. So that's nonsense. We don't really know why they did it. But here are some possibilities. One is they just wanted to see what would get through. Now, I don't think they expected cruise missiles to get through or drones to get through. And, we're now getting reports that the Turks and others were actually given some warning. I suspect they were given warning about cruise missiles and drones. What they may not have been given warning, and what really meant a lot, I think, to the Iranians, was whether one of their ballistic missiles would get through. That would tie in with what you speculated on, which is how far along are they from actually being able not only to have a nuclear weapon, but to mate it with a missile. And I think the lesson was, guess what, folks? The odds of a missile getting through are pretty low. The odds of an Israeli nuclear weapon getting through are 100%. Think twice. So that's one possibility. They wanted to see what would actually happen, what would get through. The other possibility, and it could be both, was that they wanted to use up Israel's defenses. They know that, as everybody knows, that the aid for Israel is stalled because it's tied in with the Ukrainian assistance. and the Taiwanese assistance. Meanwhile, the Israelis would be using up a lot of their capability, whether it's Patriot, whether it's THAAD, whether it's Arrow, whether it's David Sling, whatever. And so maybe that was part of the gamble here. Now, they took some major risks. For one thing, missiles were flying over the Dome of the Rock. Suppose one of them hit. I suspect that one of the reasons that the Jordanians assisted the Israelis was precisely because they were worried about this. Whether the Israelis will now act, which is the second question you raised, if they're smart, they'll actually listen to everyone. I don't know that Netanyahu listens to anyone, but if he's smart, he will listen to Biden and most others who will say, don't do anything now. You've got the world not entirely on your side, but more on your side than they've been for a long time. The Iranians called in the British, the French, and the Germans to scold them for supporting Israel. This is not a time to get everybody upset again. You're still fighting a war in Gaza that nobody likes. So the Israelis can take their time. The longer they take, by the way, the more doubt they see they sow in the minds of the Iranians. And remember, Khamenei is not a theologian. Khamenei is a politician. And as a politician, he must be thinking, okay, what are the Israelis going to do next? And the longer you get him worried, the better things are. All the nonsense the Iranians are spouting about a great victory. Remember, the Egyptians said the same thing at the beginning of the Six-Day War, and you see how that came out.
One of the things that was curious about this is that the Iranians did target military sites, or appears to have targeted military sites, and that they telegraphed almost everything they did in real time, both presaging what they were going to do with the Turks, who they knew were absolutely going to turn around and talk to the Israelis. And then when they launched ballistic missiles, they put a press release out. Ballistic missiles have been launched. I mean, was there, what does that, you know, you've always said that the Iranians are risk averse in many respects. What did that mean that they telegraphed this, started discussions in, you know, with the United Nations, that this is in response to our consulate strike? I mean, completely agree with their lying and their targeting embassies around the world, et cetera. But what does that tell you that they were so blatantly telegraphing this?
Well, I mean, look, if something got through, they would say, hooray. I think they wanted everybody to focus on that. I think they did think that something would get through. Targeting military bases, it sounds like, you know, something that their proxies do against our bases. But remember, they were targeting that the big base in southern Israel, Nevatim. They may also have been targeting Dimona. We don't know that. And they haven't said anything about that. And so from their perspective, I think they thought it would be a win-win. If anything got through, they'd say, hooray, and we told you so. We predicted it. If nothing got through, they could at least turn around, as you mentioned, to their proxies and say, hey, look, we've jumped in to support you. Now, there's one other factor here. I picked this up from somebody quite senior in the region who says that there are those Iranians who are reasonably senior. It's not clear how close they are to Raisi or the supreme leader, who are saying, you know, the Hamas people, they're Sunnis. We can't really trust them. Now, if that is part of the calculus, then their firing all these missiles was not so much to make life easier for Hamas, but to convince their other supporters that they're still there, and that whatever happens in Gaza, after all, those guys are Sunnis, but the rest of you are all Shias or Shia fellow travelers, because, you know, the Yemenis are a little different, and the Hezbollah, you know, they're Shia. The Syrians are sort of Shia. So the message is, we're still with you. Don't stray away. And if the Hamas people really are double-crossing us because they're Sunnis, we'll take care of them too.
And Nevatim, of course, the larger base, sophisticated air base in the Negev, is the home to Israel's F-35 strike fighters that were apparently used in a number of attacks, including in the Damascus strike. Byron, you have written about this, taken two bites of the apple. What's your sense, and what are the major takeaways in the wake of this? Because I think it was an astute observation that clearly deterrence in a form has failed, because now you have Iran attacking, you have Israel attacking an embassy, and on the flip side, you have Iran attacking twice now Israel, right? I mean, at some point, the piper will have to be paid for this, as Dov said. But what's your sense on where we are and where we're going?
Well, I think a couple of things. I agree with Dov. I don't know what the explicit Iranian motivation was for this attack. I think we all knew something was coming. Saturday, I was surprised, when you heard the magnitude of the strike or strikes. It reminded me a lot of, just the tension on Saturday night during the Gulf War in 1991, when Iraq launched Scuds against Israel. And there was an open question if those had chemical weapons or not. So, in the end, the markets are kind of breathing a sigh of relief today, although they're selling, at least the U.S. market is selling off from its opening highs. So, oil markets seem pretty stable. But this is by no means over. This is really a continuation of a Cold War with flare-ups, that really goes back to 1979, 1980. And I think the thing that strikes me about it is... the targets did appear to be two air bases in the Negev. There were impacts, at least there's been video, either overhead imagery or, literally, I think in one case, Israeli road graders replacing a hole in the runway. Now, this is social media stuff, so you don't always know, is that real or not? But the point is, the other thing that I find interesting is just the magnitude of the U.S., an allied contribution to defending Israel. This was telegraphed. And so, if you kind of knew the attack was coming, and large swaths of it, almost all of it was defeated, can you replicate those conditions again? I mean, the other point that I think, there's still a lot of peril here for Israel. The Hezbollah inventories are intact. And, by most measures, they would cause substantial damage to Israel if that happened. Now, what would happen to Hezbollah and Lebanon? You can see the Israeli reaction in the 2006 conflict. So I do think it increases the probability that we'll get a security supplemental through the House. I really don't know yet, Vago, if it's going to be the full Ukraine supplemental, submarine industrial base, everything the Senate had concluded. I do think that... people have to sit back and again make this link between Iran and Russia. These Iranian drone and ballistic missile capabilities in part have been paid for and expanded by the weapons that they're supplying to Russia. So the two are linked. And to think that these are two separate conflicts, I get it. There are people who are pro-Putin or anti-Ukraine, but I don't see how you can't make the link between what's happening in Ukraine and what just happened to Israel and what Iran and Russia are both capable of doing. So I do think it is like a lot of these events, it's not something brand new. We've known for a while that mass missile attacks using drones, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles are possible. It's just interesting to see this demonstrated in real time. But I also think, given the nature of the attack, the way it was telegraphed, the warnings that were provided to Middle East governments and how the U.S. had positioned for this, I wouldn't think that this should give people a lot of comfort that these sort of attacks could be swatted down with the ease that was demonstrated right on the evening of the 13th and 14th.
Dov, we're going to lose you in about a minute or two, and I just wanted to quickly kind of get your take on how you think Biden handled this. There's a sense by some that he handled it really well, saying America will defend Israel and actually doing it, but said that it would not be involved in attacking Iran. Israel's, however, making a case that it's going to retaliate, and for some, Biden didn't do enough. Talk to us briefly about that. And how you think it's going to shape the conversation that you join us every week for, which is the supplemental, and whether or not we get something clean or not clean. You know, is this going to be the whole Ukraine package that gets driven forward, or is this something that's going to be more limited in scale?
Well, you know, it's been American policy for a long time that we don't want to get dragged into a war by the Israelis, the tail wagging the dog. Nothing new here. There have been people who wanted us to be, to essentially support an Israeli strike. They've been arguing that for years. People like myself have been saying that's the last thing we want. And so if you look at it in those terms, what Biden did was defend Israel. And say, I'm not going to support an offensive strike. And it makes sense. I mean, we're supporting the Ukrainians. We're worried about Taiwan. We're worried about North Korea. It makes sense not to get dragged into a war with Iran. And quite frankly, the Israelis, I think, could handle themselves if they're not trying to take out every single nuclear facility in Iran, which they can't. But they want to take out, I don't know, Karg Island or maybe Bandar Abbas, some infrastructure, or even one or two nuclear facilities, although I don't think that would be wise, they can do that. As long as the United States and frankly, the other allies are committed to defending Israel, then we don't have to get into an offensive war, which we're just not ready for it. We're not equipped for it. Remember, too, we've been running down our own stocks to support the Ukrainians. We've even been running down Israeli stocks to support the Ukrainians. So this is not a good time to get involved in a direct war. As for the sup, what's interesting, I found what Marjorie Taylor Greene said quite interesting. Bitterly opposed to Ukraine, pushing for a sup for the Israelis. Steve Scalise has been pretty much saying the same thing. Look, it could go, you know, that it'll be both Ukraine and Israel. But right now, the momentum is such that it would be very hard for the Democrats to oppose a separate sup for Israel. And I think that's the Republican strategy. Put something up for the Israelis, dare the Democrats to shoot it down. After what's happened this weekend, it'll be very, very hard. I tend to think that on balance, they'll probably get something for Ukraine, maybe not all 60 odd billion, but don't rule out the possibility of a separate sup actually getting through just for Israel.
And what happens to Taiwan real quick before you go? Do you think that gets lumped in or that becomes separate or Ukraine and Taiwan go together? I mean, the easiest way to do this is to do this in a conjoined fashion, right?
Of course, it's easiest if you're a Democrat. It's not easiest if you're a Republican and you're Mike Johnson and you're hanging in there by a thread. One possibility, and you just raised it, would be an Israel-Taiwan sup. Again, you'll see that there are fewer right-wing Republicans who oppose aid to Taiwan. They're hard over on Ukraine, and that's quite frankly, you know, the argument that I think it was Mike Turner who made that said Republicans have been penetrated by Putin. Those are the people who care about, you know, not helping Ukraine. They're kind of indifferent or maybe even supportive of Taiwan. So you could see an Israel-Taiwan sup, which leaves Ukraine in the lurch. That's a third possibility, separate, pure Israel-Taiwan. Or what you have now. I think that I agree with Byron. The odds are still that you're going to see a sup. Johnson has said he wants to help Ukraine. Maybe he's going to have to compromise and come down in terms of the dollar figure. But if that's the case, I've heard from Europeans, and I think I mentioned this on one of the Friday shows, they would make up the dollar difference. So Maybe that's another possibility. You can't rule out any one of those three possibilities right now.
I still think it's imperative that we get Ukraine funding done, as important as it is to help Israel as well as Taiwan. It is truly existential for the Ukrainians, and it's important to do this. Dov, thanks very much. Really appreciate it. Look forward to having you back on again on Friday with the entire team to discuss, as I'm sure this is going to take many more turns as we go through it. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Pleasure being with Byron.
Byron, I just wanted to give you an opportunity to weigh in on both of those, how the administration executed, as well as sort of funding outlook, and then get to your Sunday night note for Monday.
Look, I agree with Dov. I think the administration really did a masterful job on mustering this defense. And I think, you know, the more that comes out, the U.S. role in shooting down some of these Iranian drones and ballistic missiles is pretty substantial. And that really doesn't also say what other intelligence or even kind of the backbone, the architecture that may have gone into planning what was a pretty complex operation. I still come down to this, Vago. I think, the market's reaction is kind of, okay, you know, we dodged a bullet, but people are still going to be firing bullets in that part of the world.
Right. Let's go to some geostrategic points you made in your note, as well as you're looking ahead at earnings. Give us your sense on both of those.
Yeah, I was just riffing off an event that I went to where an individual had kind of framed geopolitical issues. And, you know, it was pretty much what you would expect. China, Russia, Ukraine war, you know, North Korea, and Iran, all this was before the events of April 13th, April 14th. I've learned you never disagree completely with consensus, and those are consensus views, but I think always people ought to be thinking about, well, what else isn't on people's radar screens? What else could pose to be or prove to be a geopolitical event that really starts to influence the vector of defense spending? And you know, the three that I kind of called out were, well, first, Latin America. I mean, I'm just surprised that that doesn't figure more prominently in people looking at geopolitical risk. You know, I've talked about Haiti, Venezuela, you know, the migrant flows, just the idea that instability in that part of the world has a direct bearing on U.S. domestic politics. It's not going to really directly influence the defense sector per se, because you know, that's not a major weapons market, but it is an area or a theater, I suppose, that could command, you know, more demand for U.S. fiscal support and even just political attention. And, you know, it could yet be a very significant factor in the outcome of the 2024 election, given where immigration is figuring in public perceptions and debates these days. The other point was just maybe, you know, it's a reminder of what happened in Sydney, although, you know, on a very small scale over the weekend, but the risk that's posed by domestic terrorism, a mass terror event in the United States that's proven either to emanate from a domestic group or that has the backing of an international group. I think, you know, that could be another change, maybe as dramatic as 9/11. It'll be more interesting if it's something that comes from the from a domestic terror group. And, you know, a Civil War movie just opened up that is kind of a dystopian view of how some of that could all play out. But, you know, that ought to be on people's minds, too. You know, I don't see this, Vago, as necessarily things that are they're negatives for the defense sector in the United States. It's just it may result in different areas of emphasis. And you know, some of the intelligence C-cube stuff or ground forces or force protection, you know, that would probably do pretty well in those two other contingencies. The third one, and it's really kind of related to China, as much as people focus almost exclusively on the China-Taiwan contingency, you know, what happens if it turns out to be a China-Philippines contingency? The U.S. does have a mutual defense treaty with Philippines.
Right.
There's not a territorial claim there, but I mean, could you see something where these territorial disputes in the South China Sea really spill over into something more significant? and the U.S. is called to defend the Philippines. Well, that could be a very different type of scenario than people assume for a China-Taiwan conflict. So I don't know. I just put those out there because, part of my job is to help kind of make people think, this is consensus. Here are some other things you might consider in your view of the world.
Indeed. Let's go into a bit of lightning round earnings expectations. Let's go there and then get your sense on takeaways from Navy League and then the week ahead. Start us off with earnings expectations.
I think it'll be pretty stable. Outlays came out for March on April 10th and showed, pretty, I think it was very good, almost 7-8% growth in market outlays. That's O&M plus investment, the RDT and procurement. So no surprise on sales there. The margin issues, they aren't going to get better, but I don't have a reason to believe they're going to get a whole lot worse. And I think there's still going to be this tension you're going to see with large share buybacks and the contractors' willingness to invest ahead of need, and maybe the events of the weekend kind of changed some of that sentiment, but I doubt it. Industry seems to be pretty entrenched in the idea that they want to see firm contracts before they start investing.
Navy League takeaways.
It was a pretty quiet show, at least from the sense, Vago, that I would have hoped the Navy would have used that forum, A, to talk about some of the problems that it is confronting on its ship programs, the schedule delays, which they didn't. I spent a lot of time on kind of labor workforce issues and industrial base issues. There were, I think, three or four separate panels on those issues at the show. But I thought what the Navy really didn't do at the show was convey the choices that they had made in the FY25 request and plan, kind of pushing out all their next generation stuff. And then what plan B was going to be to try and fill it out. The idea that the CNO has talked about getting more players on the field. Okay, well, what are you doing to get those players on the field, particularly if they're autonomous systems, either in the air, surface, or undersea? So it was, I don't want to say it wasn't a disappointing show. You always learn things from these shows, but I think it was an opportunity that Navy missed to really kind of grab hold of these problems and say, here's where we're going, and this is what we need from you, industry, to do it.
I think it was a missed opportunity across the board to try to message and communicate. But especially given how many challenges the service has before it. Everybody noted the lack of unmanned progress. Everybody noted the fact that FA-XX, the next generation combat aircraft, is delayed. But the Navy did have a very good news story that it could have been telling, for example, about the recapitalization in shipyards and the investment it's making, both in people and facilities, to be able to do a much better job and prepare for that future demand signal. All right. Highlight of the week, and one of the purposes of this show is the look ahead and what folks ought to be paying attention to. Byron, what should the audience be paying attention to this week?
Well, again, there are multiple oversight hearings on the FY25 budget requests that the Senate and House Armed Services Committees are doing, and the House Appropriations Defense Subcommittee are holding. Maybe the timing is propitious, but the both NDIA and Royal United Services Institute are holding events on missile defense or integrated air missile defense on the 16th through the 18th. Wilson Center is holding an event that's going to highlight a report that was issued by Royal United Services Institute on drone warfare and the implications from NATO. So also very timely and topical. The World Bank IMF spring meetings take place this week. The full-blown meetings. There's a G7 meeting, so foreign ministers meeting in Italy. So kind of what's the broader macro backdrop, and maybe what's going to happen with Russian assets or Iran sanctions are going to be kind of intriguing to see. Brookings is doing an event on what's at stake in the 2024 election on federal debt and the implications for government spending. And finally, the Society for Military History is holding its annual meeting starting on April 18th to the 21st. I will be there. I'm going to be looking for, there are multiple presentations and panel discussions, but I think one of the sayings I like to use is the only thing new is a history you haven't read or heard. So I will be looking for some of the panel discussions that might shed some light on, how was innovation, new security challenges, how did we deal with these in the past, and what might that illuminate on the future?
Indeed. Byron, thanks very much. Always a pleasure. Hope you have a great week. Look forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Vaga.
Join us again tomorrow for our conversation with Dr. Eugene Rumer of the Carnegie Endowment and Sam Bendett of the Center for Naval Analyses. They're going to be giving us their take on Ukraine and the progress, unfortunately, Russia is making as the United States still dithers with giving Ukraine the support that it promised. Looking forward to having you join us tomorrow. Until then, have a great day.